Sent to view on the 21st of April 2008 at Chatham House with Sir Robert Hill. First of all, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to take part in this interview. First question about the propulsion side of nuclear matters. How much work actually goes on with the United States in this field? Is Britain largely independent in matters of nuclear propulsion?
You're talking currently?
Throughout your period in office, and then currently.
Throughout my period, there was no contact with America, effectively, because contact was broken off by Americans in 1963. And I retired in 1993.
So it'd be fair to suggest Rickover was the aim of the NDA was to get Britain on its feet in nuclear propulsion.
Yes.
That's one way you might look at it. That was achieved then.
Yes.
Yeah, by 63. Does any actual collaboration unofficially take place?
Not to my knowledge.
No. In propulsion, Britain has an engineering problem, say. And the Americans may have also had this problem, may have solved it or not solved it. Was there ever issues of maybe trying to get more collaboration, or was it just not needed? Was Britain quite happy with its standard of engineering, what it was achieving?
On the whole, Britain was expected to solve its own problems. If requests could have been passed, could be passed to the Office of Naval Reactors, but with no expectation of necessarily getting a reply. A reply might be given, but not in any sensible detail. Perhaps in general terms, a statement might have been made, but I'm not aware of them feeling under an obligation to solve our problems, nor us feeling that they had any sub-obligation.
Are you allowed to go and talk to other countries?
No.
So the terms of the NDA limited Britain completely from talking to other countries, even though there wasn't US, UK transfer?
Article 7. Neither party, however, shall communicate classified information or transfer or permit access or use of materials or equipment made available by the other party pursuant to this agreement to any national or international organisation unless authorised to do so by such other party. That's absolutely clear.
Do you think the Americans kept it?
Because yes.
Were you aware they always kept it?
Absolutely.
In the 1970s, there was quite a lot from up top, Heath was quite interested in this idea of maybe collaborating with France in the nuclear realm. You at the actual service level, what was the type of agreement, what was the type of thinking to such a...
Well, the first matter with France happened in 1962. You said 1980. But in 1962 there was an issue.
Yes, was that when they wanted to, with De Gaulle, they wanted to try and do submarine cooperation?
Well, I'm not aware of that. But in 1962, Foster Wheeler of the UK applied for permission to supply heat exchangers to France. the heat exchangers were not considered by the UK to be nuclear, nor to contain US information, since they were Foster Wheeler UK design. And the matter went up to the Prime Minister, who decided that the deal could go ahead. The US State Department objected, saying that as long as it remains United States policy to refrain from assisting all other countries except the United Kingdom in nuclear defense matters, they expect the UK, by reason of the exclusive arrangements with the United States, similarly to refrain. In the event, the UK declined to prevent Foster Wheeler from accepting the contract, So the United States puts pressure on the company's United States parent company, and the contract was dropped by Foster Wheeler UK. So that was the episode that made very clear to the UK what the French, what the US would deal with and interpret the 58 agreement, as we call it. And this is the relevant paper, where with a very detailed, very detailed statement, which I can read in if you wish, about the basis of the United States policy on nuclear matters, which runs to 2-3 pages. The other papers relate to the discussion at prime ministerial level in the UK about the supply of parts for the submarine to France. But this is where it specifies very clearly what the United States approach would be.
Yeah. There's similar things in the 70s with Heath. A lot of Cromer, the ambassador out in Washington, basically says, under the terms of the 58th agreement, there's no way Britain can do anything towards France without keeping the Americans completely informed at all stages.
Well, I think, yes, I thought it was in the 80s, but maybe you're right. But we did get further useful information about how Rickover intended to apply Article 7 on dissemination. And it turned out that if a type of equipment was provided to the UK by Westinghouse or Electric Boat or any other company under the agreement, the UK was barred from providing that type of equipment to other nations. Hence, in the field of nuclear submarine air purification, which is not part of the nuclear submarine propulsion plant, the UK had been provided with CO2 scrubbers for Dreadnought. But the UK company, Wellman, who made it, was therefore barred from providing CO2 scrubbers to the French. However, to make oxygen, Dreadnought used, inverted commas, oxygen candles, while for Valiant, the UK used high-pressure electrolyzers developed by a UK company, Constructors John Brown, CJB Limited. Electrolyzers had not been supplied by the US to the UK, and hence the company was allowed to provide electrolyzers for the French nuclear submarines, and did so. I don't have any information about the 1970s or 1980s moves for collaboration with the French, except that there was a general government move across a wide field, including defence, for collaboration with the French. And I would say that when told of the constraints of the 1958 agreement, some in the Ministry of Defence were incredulous that the UK should continue to be bound by an agreement more than 25 years old, from which we had ceased to benefit from the USA. No cooperation took place, and in fact it transpired that the French knew the constraints on the UK better than many UK ministers and civil servants. That would be my view.
So would it be fair to say the MDA, in your opinion, is outdated? It's not really required anymore for
nuclear propulsion. No, it's never outdated. We signed an agreement and we're bound to it, as far at least we were throughout my time with the United States.
Because I think at the end of the year, it can't be either way, you can drop out of it.
Sorry?
I think either party can cancel the agreement if they give a year's notice.
No, I haven't read that.
That's one of the clauses on Rickover. was he this all-encompassing personality which seems to be the general feeling? Was he the main man, so to speak?
Yes, on the nuclear propulsion side, he was totally in charge of all aspects of the nuclear propulsion program.
So, caught in Eisenhower or caught in Kennedy, like McMillan did, is that pretty much a waste of time unless you could get Rick over to on board, so to speak? Because Mountbatten and him reached a report, some suggest.
Yes, it was Mountbatten who effectively won Rick over to helping the Brits. Do you want the authoritative statement on that? In September 1957, so that's the year before the agreement, Rickover wrote a letter to the commanding officer of the Nautilus, Commander Anderson, in which he, after stating that he had gone all out to help the British get complete information about the American program, Rickover wrote, "I did this because of my feeling of the urgency about the international situation, my admiration for the British, and particularly my great liking for Admiral Mountbatten." So that was his own statement.
So it's not just a functionalist relationship then, in that sense. Personalities at the top do make a difference, so to speak.
Well, yes, I would say in all situations, but certainly in it was relations between people were absolutely fundamental, both in the propulsion aspect, the 58 agreement coming into being, and the people who took part in it, Westinghouse on the part of the United States and Rolls-Royce primarily on behalf of the UK. And that was entirely a personality issue. It was not the most natural alignment before negotiations began.
About
how it was formed?
Or how it worked in the actual before cutting off?
No. Most of my information is about the process towards setting up the agreement in 1958 through to 1959. But the operation, do you want my questions, or are we going to stick to yours?
No, I mean, I've been poorly briefed, to be honest with you.
Have
you? I'm on the tape, I won't say it. But if you've got some questions, you want to bring up, I mean, fair do. The whole idea is that then, do you just want to go through?
Or? Up to you.
What parts of the 58 agreement apply to nuclear power submarines?
Well, obviously Article 3, which had A, B, C, D, E parts. Part A was the significant one, transfer of a complete submarine propulsion plant, spares, information covering design, manufacture, operation and safety. Also replacement cores and fuel elements for a 10-year period. That's Article 3A. B was about U-235 fuel, C pricing, D reprocessing. I have no knowledge of them ever having been, well obviously supply of fuel, but pricing, reprocessing, I don't know if anything happened. E, indemnity. Article 6 about security was highly relevant and enforced by the United States. Article 7, dissemination, we've already touched on.
What happens as a result of the...
Well, I think the next question you should ask is probably not on that. What about Article 2A5? 2A5 is extremely interesting. It's Article 2, exchange of information. A5.
research, development and design of military reactors to the extent and by such means as may be agreed. Military reactors only. That's interesting.
But you would think from reading that that it would enable an ongoing dialogue between the United States and the United Kingdom on
propulsion
yeah. reactors for submarines.
Why do you think it ceases? I mean, that seems to be the natural question from Kurt.
Well, when documents were drafted, giving effect, when documents were drafted giving effect to the 1958 agreement, the United Kingdom assumed that this paragraph, the one you just read out, would allow them to receive information beyond the design of the plant actually transferred. And a license agreement was drawn up accordingly and agreed within the UK. However, Rickover would have none of it. He argued that since the paragraph required extent and means still to be agreed, it could not be applied in the documents giving effect instantaneously to Article 3. And he refused to sign up any further agreements until this was agreed by the UK. And also one other thing he hung out for and wouldn't sign until the UK had agreed to it. And that was the total exclusion of the Atomic Energy Authority, the UK Atomic Energy Authority, as a recipient of United States information in any form. He would not allow to go to the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. So there were two facts that he insisted on before he allowed the United States to sign up to the document that gave effect to the 58 agreement.
Rickover, as you were saying before, it seems to be the head honcho above the president even. He seemed to just say...
Well, nothing happened unless he agreed to it. And only things that he wished to have happen, happened. Because he had headed up the team which actually designed and built the first pressurized water reactor for the Nautilus.
Here, isn't it a case of maybe you don't want to give away his information, it's his baby, so to speak?
Yes, I think he guarded it extremely jealously. But he wasn't totally in charge, because there is evidence, which I will come to, that actually he was instructed to make the technology available to the UK. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, go ahead.
So we've dealt with Article 285, and we've dealt with other aspects. But do you want to go back to before?
Go to the actual... the genesis of it.
The genesis.
It's
crucial, I think. The genesis of the agreement is absolutely crucial. This is from a book, which I don't have. I can't get a copy. Amazon can't find it for me. But it's by an engineer, Sir Alex Smith, who was a Rolls-Royce engineer, 1956-1957. And... I'd like to read it to you.
Yeah, you've got like a significant paragraph.
Well, it's a bit of a story, really, but it's a good one. Right, well, Rickover was visiting a team in Rolls-Royce that were doing preliminary work on Ipcwest submarine reactor before any information exchange with the States. He was accompanied by the chief technologist of his team in America, a man whom we came to know, admire and respect greatly. His name was Dr. Harry Mandel, M-A-N-D-I-L, a delightful character who seemed to have Rickover's total confidence, and yet who had a knack of dealing with his more choleric outbursts, even to the extent of saying occasionally, "Oh, shut up, Admiral, let's stick to the engineering." and Rickover did not seem to mind. Another member of the visiting party told us quietly that there were plenty of insulting stories about Rickover in circulation in America. The morning session with Rickover was very difficult. He was at his obnoxious worst, Corinthian in execration of standards in the engineering industry, and all but spat upon the design efforts of the Old Hall team. So critical was he. Whether it was his audacity, his arrogance, or just plain forgetfulness about where he was, it took a lot of calming interventions from Harry Mandel to prevent the meeting from collapsing in disarray. "Oh, come on, Admiral, for Christ's sake. It's not as bad as all that. Remember, you're in Rolls-Royce. They've got a pretty good track record in designing things." We got through the morning, strained though it was, thanks largely to the emollient influence of Mandel and to the development of a good rapport between Mandel and Lombard, who was the Rolls-Royce chief engineer. And then we broke up for lunch. Lord Hives, chairman, had come in for the occasion just to be a host at lunch and was waiting in the dining room. Lombard immediately introduced the bad-tempered admiral. "This is Lord Hives, chairman of Rolls-Royce." Rickover, still very rude, rapped out, "A lord, eh? Chairman, eh? What are you then, a banker, a lawyer, or what?" He had obviously met some British chairmen and was not impressed. Hives was perfect. With a big, broad smile on his genial face, he said, "What, me? No, 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 no. Me? I'm just a mechanic. Just a bloody plumber." Rickover was thrown and disconcerted, completely lost for words. That was an answer he had not expected. He began to mellow. As their conversation flowed, he realized that this man had known Henry Royce himself, had worked for him, and had absorbed from him his passion for engineering excellence. Even Rickover could not dare to criticize the standards set by Henry Royce. Throughout lunch, he kept asking questions about Royce, and it was fascinating for the rest of us just to listen to Hives telling Rickover about Royce's obsession with achieving perfection and about how he designed his first aero engine, the Eagle, in 1915, when he was in poor health and far removed from the company in Derby. He gave an account of the testing of the engine, which he had supervised, and of going to see Royce to report on the trials. It was a privilege just to be there, listening. Rickover was captivated. We all were. As lunch was ending, Hives suddenly asked Rickover if he would like to see something of the works. He readily accepted, and off they went, not in a Rolls or a Bentley, which Rickover might have expected the chairman of Rolls-Royce to be driving, but in a very modest little Hillman, driven by Hives himself. I thought to myself that Rickover was about to experience something new, a chairman who knew where the shop floor was, who could conduct a guest around, and who would be recognized by the workmen there, who would not be at all surprised to see him. Back at the Old Hall, we got on with discussions with Mandel, so very much improved without the acerbic interruptions of Rickover. We gathered from him that the Admiral, as he kept calling him, was under instructions from on high to find a way of cooperating with the Brits to enable them to achieve a nuclear submarine, but that Rickover himself was still very opposed to the idea. Hives brought Rickover back to rejoin us in mid-afternoon. He was a changed man, subdued, pleasant, cooperative, uncritical, and no further put-downs or denigrations of British engineering escaped his lips. It is my view, the author's view, that the hour of dialogue between Rickover and Hives, followed by the short tour of the works, changed everything in the British nuclear submarine programme, even though nuclear submarines were never mentioned. Rickover began to realise the great strength of Rolls-Royce, in which he undoubtedly saw a company with a superb tradition of engineering excellence, a company which could reach the very high standards which he saw as essential in nuclear submarine engineering. He made up his mind on that day, if there were to be established a form of cooperation between his organization in America and Britain, then Rolls-Royce was the company to which it should be entrusted. He let it be known that he was going to recommend that his organization in America should receive a delegation from Britain, consisting of naval officers, engineers, and scientists from various companies and from Harwell. He then pointed straight at Lombard, saying, "And I want you to be there. Without you, it's not on. Lombard winced visibly. He felt that he'd had more than enough to do with aero engine problems and was extremely reluctant to be absent from them for a couple of weeks. Rickover and Mandel left. A delegation was due to December to go to America. There were nearly 30 members, with 5 from Rolls-Royce, Lombard, 3 design engineers, blah, blah, blah. And the whole delegation was under the leadership of Mandel. So that was the 1957 visit by...
While Rolls-Royce is 18 years, you agree?
Well, I mean, that is the only absolutely first-hand account that I have. I mean, it was generally recognised that he had been impressed by Rolls-Royce during his visit to the UK. This is the only account that I'm aware of the significant event reported. However, there was more to it than that. Because, I need to start the digression. Now, this paper, which I wrote in 2005, went over to the States. In fact, a man who gave a presentation with me in London was a man called Ted Rockwell, who was Rickover's chief engineer till 1985. He came over in his 80s to give this lecture with me at short notice in London. Not the written paper, but the... And when he took the words back to the States, he had it all recorded and read through to Harry Mandel, who was very ill and had a brain tumour. And Ted Rockwell then emailed me. So Mandel's addition to that account by Alex Smith was that Rickover and Mandel both had the highest regard for Pearson, the head of Rolls-Royce, chairman, chief executive, I think. Mandel said he had a lot of dealings with him and told me, Ted Rockwell, that Pearson was one of the best persons he had ever known. In addition, Charlie Weaver of the Bettis Lab had our confidence, US, and was also on excellent terms with Pearson. As you know, a basic tenet of Rickover's operations was to place trust and responsibility in a few top individuals as the best way to ensure a successful project. They felt that the Pearson-Weaver combination was a good one. So that's a 2005 comment on the account by Alex Smith from a man who was there.
Yeah.
And who accompanied Rickover on all his visits to the UK. So Harry Mandel was absolutely crucial to getting the agreement and the selection of Rolls-Royce as the party. Okay?
Was Royce a good pick? A good choice?
Yes.
Yeah.
In my view, it was excellent. It worked out extremely well for us. They rose to the challenge and we had very good service from Rolls-Royce.
What did Rickover trait collaboration with Britain? What's the British attitude, reaction to being left in there, given the cold shoulder, for a better term?
Well, I think there was initial we shouldn't have been surprised because Rickover had it written in at the outset that the exchange of information from Westinghouse to Rolls on what was known as the supply contract would continue until 1 year after Dreadnought plant first operated, which was 1963. I spoke about the license agreement having been cancelled by Rickover. So some clauses from the license agreement went into the supply contract, which was effectively the US-UK contract, which authorised Westinghouse to pay to transfer the plant. And the time limit was inherent in that supply contract. And the Rickover stuck to that time limit, and we should not have been surprised.
Were there attempts to win him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there was an attempt to... there was an attempt to have an extension, yes. But basically, I've got the reference here, but the Director General Ships in Bath, whose name was Simms, in August of 1963, sent a note up to say that the Westinghouse Royals contract was about to expire and that we ought to make an effort to get an extension so that we could continue to receive information relevant to Dreadnought and the S5W plant. And I believe that initially this was attempted at through the diplomatic channels and was rejected. I believe, although I don't have any record of it, that a delegation went over to the States led by the controller and was rejected out of hand. I think I know where there would be an account of that visit to the United States in 63 or early 64. But when I tried to get it from the Public Records Office, I was told that it was in the basement of the
asbestos. Yeah, I've had that a few times. I'm sure that it's taken on the really.
However, recently I've been told that the files that I want to look at are being copied, and that I will be told when I can go and read them in the Public Records Office. So I'm waiting for that.
Did you freedom of information? Yeah.
Well.
Did you?
I keep nudging them every 6 months.
I don't get me started on that. Everything goes appears in the War Office. Like, how convenient if it's
quite modern.
I don't. My friends dealt a lot of French stuff, and they don't even know any stuff in 56 or something. Go away. You're barking up the wrong tree there. On the security side of nuclear technology and information transfer, this is one of the US's big concerns, that things would leak out. How do you think the United Kingdom did in securing its knowledge it got? Do you know of any leaks?
By us or by them?
By the United Kingdom itself.
By the United Kingdom. Well, I think my comment would be, I would say that it was a constant concern, and there were a number of minor breaches, accidental in the main, upon which the United States seized to keep us up on our good behaviour. Any time they detected one, they'd been straight down on us. So just to remind us of the security. In particular, great care had to be taken with submarine visitors' access after the reactor compartment, or after the forward reactor compartment bulkhead. Also with any photographs taken on board, or indeed in simulators.
Visitors or people working?
Well, just, I mean, if we, for instance, had any sort of press campaign, photographers were around, which obviously the Navy wanted because it was usually provided good PR, good recruiting material. We had to be very, very careful that there were no gauges in sight that gave away information about the performance of the submarine. The Americans were very hot on that. But there were undoubtedly breaches. But the most blatant breach, which caused a mighty storm from the United States, occurred in 1982 with the publication of a Learned Society paper by Vice Admiral Sir Ted Horlick, titled Submarine Propulsion in the Royal Navy. The paper contained a great deal of engineering information of a general nature and described some specific engineering problems encountered and overcome. In response to the United States' objections, the MOD replied that nothing contained in the paper was rated in the UK to have a security classification above restricted. And if the United States would not talk to us, and we were not allowed to talk to anyone else on nuclear submarine matters, the United States should not be surprised if our classification diverged from theirs from time to time.
It's quite a nice little quote.
I thought it was rather neat.
Do you know of any US infringements of problems and leaks?
Absolutely not. A question that is often asked is, surely the Americans must have given some information to the French to allow the French to have nuclear submarines. And I would say absolutely not. And what people forget is that the French submarine program started quite a few years after our own, by which time Rickover's team had designed the shipping port civil reactor.
Yeah.
And this shipping port was important because it was a proof of concept. Purely civil nuclear power station, pressurized water reactor, because the design was based on a plant which he had hoped to power the US carrier. And Rickover insisted that to be any use to American industry and to commence a civil nuclear program, he had all the design codes for shipping port declassified. So of course, although they were based on submarine information which had a high security classification, he had them all rewritten by his team and declassified so that the information would be available for the US civil industries to encourage them in a civil power plant program. So all of that was in the clear. And that would be absolutely invaluable information to the French setting off if they had had it from the outset.
So Nicholas's obsession with security, the British, sort of gives potential other powers a key of, this is how we build a nuclear propulsion plant.
But then that is my answer to people who say, how did the French get there so fast? They had all the shipping port information. That would be enormous help, particularly on materials testing, and so on.
With diplomatic documents, which I've got mostly from the 1970s, but they strongly suspect the Americans have thrown stuff over to the French. But that seems to be quite...
I would say absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Though under the NDA, Britain cooperated for 5 years with the United States.
Well, they gave 5 years to transfer the information to us.
What did Britain get from it? Was it a good deal at the end of the day?
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the priceless gift. I know we paid for it. Westinghouse, but it was effectively a gift of a proven, reliable propulsion plant for Dreadnought, which did act, as Rickover had said it would, as a measuring standard for subsequent UK designs. It was the benchmark. The core itself, and its how it was made, and the control rod drive mechanism were especially important and valuable. We acquired many valuable shipbuilding techniques for Vickers and Barrow. We acquired quality and quality control standards higher than generally found in the UK industry. Much higher. The demands insisted on.
Industry in the 70s.
Absolutely. We acquired plant operating standards and procedures of a much higher standard than were prevalent even in the submarine service at the time. In particular, the practice of having procedure authorization groups to vet and issue written procedures for everything that was done on board, and the practice of maintainers and operators being required to follow written instructions, written procedures, step by step at all times, with proper processes for amending and verifying the written instruction if a difficulty was found. Also, two specific procedures, tag out and rip out, were very disciplined ways of indicating any valve that was in an abnormal lineup for maintenance and why it was there, and or if it had been taken out to be replaced. So they were inherited from the American program and were very tough and strong disciplines for maintaining safety. We acquired a focus on core safety, a focus on the close control of radioactivity within and outside the primary loop, a we acquired respect for and concern to minimize radiation. And so, and we're talking, comparing Rickover standards, which he imposed happily on us and we accepted in 1985, that I maintain were way above those generally to be found in the Atomic Energy Authority at the time.
So
much more detailed concern, much more rigorous approach, safety and radioactivity and radiation.
It's interesting that, because I mean, a lot of people have this attitude in the military, it's pretty gung-ho, civilians always have to sort them out.
Well, I think that the Atomic Energy Authority, as evidenced at Doon Rae, were pretty gung-ho with radiation.
Sure, yeah. A few years was a problem, wasn't it?
Whereas, and without Rickover, we would not have done this. I mean, any more than the Russians did. They were extremely careless with radiation, radioactivity. We would have left to our own devices, been somewhere a lot better than the Russians. We would have been nowhere as demanding and disciplined as the Americans. So that was a hugely important acquisition, which we have continued through to the present day.
So and that was high standards set, the new bench, the new level sort of.
Absolutely. And that, you know, was one of the absolutely greatest things we inherited, as well as the plant itself. We also inherited, because he insisted on it, an organisation for the nuclear propulsion program, which mirrored that in the United States, fit for the purpose of managing the design, building, maintenance and operation of nuclear submarines. And that was Rickover who insisted on the organization that we eventually, under his intense pressure, forced us to have. Where's that paper?
Yes.
And it's remarkable how close our organization came to the US one, having been a total shambles when he visited in 57. It was our organization of our nuclear submarine program was a total shambles, and there's plenty of evidence to back up that.
So Britain was really quite a long way behind on its safety standards.
And organisation, project management particularly. But that's a comparison of US and the UK that he brought into being.
I mean, Rickover seems to get a bit of a bad press.
Well, he was deeply unpopular in the States.
Well, that's what Sir Robert was saying. He was saying there's a reason he was a two-star admiral for a long time.
Well, I mean, he was...
He was a pretty obnoxious man.
He was. He was passed over for promotion from captain to admiral.
Did you ever meet Rickover?
No.
No.
Thank God.
Yes. Yeah, that seems to be a good thing. What do the Americans get? What do you think the Americans got out of it for the 5 years it carried on?
Well, I'm tempted to say very little. Obviously, it provided Westinghouse with another plant to make, which is business.
Business.
Right? But what I think a lot of people don't know, or have forgotten, or don't realise, because it was an important fact in the whole business, is that the plant design by Westinghouse, which is labelled S5W, in other words, the fifth generation of Westinghouse plant for submarines, S for submarines, fifth generation, W by Westinghouse.
Stand for submarine.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Because Sir Robert was, I don't think it stands for submarine, is it?
Yes, it does.
It does. I don't know. Yeah.
But that was the last plant designed by Westinghouse for the Navy. All subsequent plants for the US Navy were by General Electric. I think that's extremely relevant when talking about why, for instance, the contract or the exchange of information ceased in 1963. Because by then it was a historic plot. Any further developments for the US Navy were by General Electric, a totally different plant to the one we had acquired. And it would have been quite dangerous to transfer information relevant to a GE plant to us for a possible application for a Westinghouse plant. It would have been difficult to interpret the information. We had no basis for doing so. And furthermore, in Rickover's operation wanted to concentrate on future development of GE, and they did not want to be bothered with other than maintaining their own S5W submarines. They didn't develop the plant any further. So that's also quite relevant as to why Article 7 had no real significance after 1963. It gave NATO a few more submarines to fight the Cold War. You could argue that that was a benefit. I don't know.
Meaning strategic, sorts of an extra couple of hundred nukes at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, that's 6, right.
6,000 around.
We only contributed a few at a time. But I think there's one respect in which possibly we can claim to have helped the Americans as a result of the agreement. The first generation of UK nuclear submarines had a much lower radiated noise signature than Dreadnought.
Mm.
Much lower.
Is important because when you try and hunt these things,
well, you get a signal. Radiated noise is what gives away your presence. And UK submarines were much quieter. And when Rickover came over to attend the launch of Dreadnought in Vickers, he saw a bit of our design, enough to show him that it was radically different in respect of noise isolation, mountings and so on. And it is said that immediately following that visit, when he went back to the States, he instigated a tremendous noise quieting program for the whole of the US submarines, and that happened with the Thresher class. And the timing is right. It's very likely. It's a story that I believe because it is very credible.
So the Americans, at the end of the day...
They would never admit it. Because very quickly, of course, the amount of money they spent on it, their submarines became even quieter than ours. But we probably set them off on that trail earlier than they would have done it.
So there's a real practical benefit from the US point of view.
So it's a small claim, and it might not be agreed by an American.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think it's very hard to claim very much that they would have benefited. I don't know, for instance, whether their acquiring Holy Log as a base had anything to do with this at all. I don't know, but politically, you know, it must have been, application must have been made for them to have based their fleet of submarines at Holy Log. I know none of the politics of that at all. But it's possible, it is at least conceivable.
I mean, the NDA is shrouded with Sputnik and all the rest of it. So maybe there's quite a lot of panic within the US policy circle. And that's just hazarding a guess, I'm not sure. I know Eisenhower had his own private intel from his U-2 spy planes, and they were basically reporting back, Khrushchev, he's claiming he's churning out missiles like sausages, but where are all these missiles? So Ike, in that sense, was a lot more savvy than his advisors who weren't privy to the U-2 knowledge in that sense. So I'm quite sceptical when people say, well, it was all because of Sputnik. And I sort of say, well, the guy at the top, but maybe that didn't trickle down to Rickover, who could have pushed in that.
Well, I think they were panicked by Sputnik. I really do.
But it was a phenomenal effect on the populace. And yeah. I don't think a president could have just sat there and went, it's all right, don't you worry, say their hands here, even though he was a general, etc.
Absolutely.
He did claim that a lot of the time.
Yeah, it had a huge impact right around the world.
else about the agreement you'd like to talk about, or anything to add? Not add?
Which aspect?
Mostly, we've talked about Genesis and its operation, more about them. Were there any overtures after 63? I mean, you've said there was an attempt, or after that was Britain basically just resigned to its fate, so to speak.
Well, it wasn't a bad fate.
No.
You know, we were designing some pretty good submarines, and we were masters of our destiny. Mm. So, are we on to why did Rick overtake this lion, really?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, you used the expression, Rick ever believed that we could and should stand on our own feet. It's a phrase he used more than once. A quote here from February 1958, the time when the big meeting happened on the 24th of February. Admiral Rickover made it clear that one of the important factors in his advice that we should take from them a complete submarine plant was that it would give us practical knowledge which would greatly facilitate our own research work in this field, so that when we came to build the second and subsequent submarines, we could stand on our own feet. And this is from the horse's mouth. He knew that if he left the door open, we would be endlessly coming to his office whenever we were in trouble, or simply to save money. And my classic one, and I can't find it, damn it, is a Treasury letter giving grudging approval for funds for the development of a longer life core. I can't find the paper. I can quote from it, but I can't find it. Which is absolute classic.
Treasury files are always amusing. It's a big clash of culture. They're always trying to save money, and the FO are always looking at political problems, and the Ministry of Defence are really amusing. That works.
So in 1961, the Dreadnought project team was seeking funds to enable RRNA to develop a longer life core, labelled Corda, for the programme. Treasury approval was grudging in the extreme. This was a quote from a Treasury letter. What worries us most is the lack of firm indication of how far the Americans might be prepared to offer practical advice and help. You have told us that their preliminary reactions are favourable. From this, you and the Ministry of Defence infer that CORDEV is not directed on lines which have already found to be fruitless. This, however, does not get us very far. It remains possible that the Americans may later produce suggestions to reduce the cost and improve the efficiency of the scheme. In these circumstances, we are prepared rather reluctantly to agree that you should start commitments on the scheme, on the understanding that these are kept to the minimum until the outcome of the approach to the Americans is known, and that strenuous efforts are made through ministerial and US Navy channels to produce a full answer as soon as possible. To summarize, this is a three-page letter. To summarize, I should feel easier in my mind if a further determined effort were made at once to persuade the Americans to show their hand in detail. If, however, you and the Ministry of Defence are entirely satisfied that such an approach would be counterproductive, and that we must make a start with your plan, I agree that you may proceed with the first stage of the scheme.
Was that wrap up?
No.
No, it was just a Treasury.
It's a Treasury letter.
All right.
Isn't that fantastic?
It doesn't change throughout the 70s.
Exactly. But you see, that's why Rick Evans knew bloody well.
Yeah.
He didn't totally cut us off. He'd be forever wasting his time.
It's really like that in the weapons part in the 70s. It's absolutely... there's a project called Super Antelope. It's upgrading Polaris, basically. And all the Treasury keeps saying is, well, you can have the first 3 months funded, but go for the cheapest option, basically. And the MOD go, we can't have the cheapest option, it doesn't work, there's no pattern to tell it. And the Treasury went, can't we get the American system, then it's cheaper. And they basically end up getting an American system in the end.
Yep.
Because it's the cheapest off the shelf bang for your buck, basically. Yep. And of course, he was quite a savvy political operator.
He was
not just a barking admiral, screams and shouts. He was pretty astute.
Oh, he was hugely astute, and this was his skill. But he wasn't promoted by the Navy. So three members of his team, Harry Mandel, Ted Rockwell, and a third member, went to Washington to lobby their senators and congressmen to get him promoted.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And they were very effective in their lobbying. Well, I'll read you what happened. Yes, you can't understand any of it really without really understanding the character, the personality of the character. It's just fundamental to the whole thing. And you know, he was born in Poland in 1900. His family emigrated when he was six. 1953, he was passed over for promotion. Because of Ted Rockwell, Harry Mandel, and the third man lobbying senators and congressmen, drawing their attention to the fact that the Nautilus, which hadn't yet sailed, was entirely due to Rickover's drive and determination, Congress intervened and, for the first time ever, turned down the 39 promotions proposed by the promotions board.
First time ever.
They because they just went for routine signing off, right?
Yeah.
And they rejected them.
Well, what's the point?
There were some people pending pending an investigation of the entire promotion system. The Navy Secretary was threatened with the whole promotion system being subject to a congressional investigation. Rather than let this happen, the Navy Secretary ordered the selection board to reconvene and to select for promotion one engineering duties captain, quote, experienced and qualified in the field of atomic propulsive machinery for ships.
Yeah.
Despite being faced with only one eligible candidate, it took the promotion board members more than 2 hours to overcome their intense reluctance and fulfill this remit.
He needed a PR team, that's what he needed.
He was his own PR team. And so, effectively, he had been promoted by Congress. And so from then on, anything he wanted to do, he called together, he asked the Joint Congress and House Representative Committee to convene, because he wished to make a report to him. And he would spout for hours and hours and hours, and they were just jilly. So he, the whole of his politics was flattering and keeping Congress closely informed. And this totally overcame anything the Navy wanted to do to bypass him or remove him or anything else. He was Congress's tech. Because, of course, he had this joint position in the Atomic Energy Commission and in the Navy. So that was his power base. His power base was Congress. And he could achieve a huge amount from that power base.
They're the ones who sign off on all the checks and stuff, aren't they, Congress? You've got to be careful what you do with the old US Congress.
Where were we?
We were coming to Rick Holmes. I think it basically answered the thing for Britain always coming back.
Right, yeah.
Money.
Because he knew what would happen. We would be forever hanging on their coattails. So, for those of him in the programme, actually it was quite a relief not to be expected on every occasion to get an American opinion on our decisions, or save money by trying to get something from America. It released us from a great weight of extra bureaucracy and burden to actually get on with the job within the money that we, you know, had available.
Pretty successful, Dean.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, not immediately. The first generation of British nuclear submarines were a long way apart from being quiet in operation. They were quite the job to operate, quite difficult. The next generation, which was the Swiftsure class, owed a lot to Dreadnought information. Vast aspects of design you could identically trace to as Dreadnought, as well as keeping the quietening features. In fact, the Swiftsure class was universally known as the nearly as good as Dreadnought submarine. The next generation after that was the Swiftsure class, which was the first world-class submarine that we produced.
When did you come from the books of this one?
Trafalgar?
Yeah.
I don't remember the dates. Some mid-80s, 86, 87. Trafalgar class, and that's it. I mean, it is a world-class submarine, no doubt about it. And widely acknowledged to be so. So we learned a lot through as a result of Dreadnought. We didn't develop the nuclear plant much at all, apart from developing longer and longer lives for the core, which is crucial, because the first core only lasted about three and a half years before needing to be changed out in a refit. It's a very expensive process. The first longer life core B lasted at least double that. Core C, further extension, and now for Trident we have a full life core. But they're all basically still on the same technology, fundamental technology transfer to Trident. So Rolls-Royce did an absolutely superb job, but it was very cautious work. And because to do anything else just cost a huge amount of R&D and we didn't have the money. So we stuck to our knitting and just made incremental improvements on lifetime, mainly on life, and always the pressure on guys. But the Rolls-Royce did a very good job in that respect.
You happen to conclude it, seems a good point to come on.
What? Finish?
Yeah, if you'd like, or is there anything else you'd like to say? I mean, get off your chest.
Well, yeah. We've covered most of it, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, the ones about, we talked about, transfer and stuff, we answered that earlier, didn't we? And,
Well, we didn't say why was the information transfer firm to firm?
Yeah, oh, yeah, you want to talk about that?
Well, it's distinctly different from the weapons scene.
Yeah, because that's...
Where they are government lab to government lab. Mm. So, I mean, this is quite different to firm to firm, Westinghouse to Rolls-Royce, right? And the reason is that Rickover said, and sort of believed, that, partly he did it to offload his team from the obligation. If he could pass it to industry, it would help. But he also believed and said to the Senate that... doing it on firm to firm would provide some distance of government if anything went wrong. And there's quite a good, useful exchange on that subject, which I can dig out for you. Because it is useful, it's relevant, it is significantly different to the weapon scene. If this were handled on a government-to-government basis, we would be responsible for making it for them, inspecting it for them, installing it for them, and obviously if anything went wrong, we would be at fault. Right? So that's a pretty clear statement to his own people. But it was an interesting follow-up from one of the senators, to that statement. This is extracts from telegrams between Gideon Washington and the UK.
Right there. It does beg the question, though, was he expecting something to go wrong with you?
Well, he was just very, very cautious. He wasn't expecting something to go wrong, but he was...
He was in the contingency. That's the key point, I think.
Yeah.
As long as they're not legally...
Absolutely. That's right.
...chased them.
Absolutely right. You know, he was... always went down the line of what the agreement said and making sure that the agreement said what he wanted to say and no more, no less than the other people. It's a good way of doing business.
What was it set up? There's none of this whole appealing to culture and all the rest of it. If you do it in purely legalistic terms, no one can complain, at least if things don't go the way they want, because they know the laws of the game.
That's right.
On to firm, in was this a good way? Would it have been better to have gone the same way of weapons, or was it better to keep it? No.
I honestly know so little about the weapons scene. I'm not sure if I can comment.
You've already answered that it was a good thing. It worked well anyway.
Worked
so.
Well. It worked well. This is one of my favourite bits of paper because the deal was actually done. Well, I'll read you the background. The 24th of January 58 was the absolutely crucial day. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Have you got this bit of paper? Which is the note of the meeting on the 24th?
I privately got it. Yeah. Just give us.
Well, I'll just. I mean, it's just, it's just a very useful source of Rickover attributed remarks.
Savvy's
emphasising it's him asking Temple not to the United States. This is not a government, it's an admiral to...
You can imagine any admiral behaving that way these days.
No.
It's just, any civil servant.
No,
only ministers can behave like that.
Unfortunately.
It's incredible.
Rickover seems to be the last big military personality who can pretty much dictate the running of the policy.
Well, the United States will never let it happen again. But it was...
It's no worse than letting it all fall into the hands of the NSC advisor or Secretary of State or whatever.
Two stories. The world is full of Rickover stories.
It is. There's plenty of them.
You've heard a lot of them.
Yeah. There's a few one-liners I do.
There's plenty of Rickover's got some good ones.
I like Kissinger's best. He's got some real corkers. Rickover's one of them. He's up there. It's because he's so detested by virtually everyone who works in it, except for his very close team.
His close team.
You notice this with these personalities, who everyone seems to don't like. Their close team are just fiercely loyal, so they must be.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the first time I drafted a talk, a paper about Rickover, I sent it over to the Office of Naval Reactors for comment, and got some very good comments and got back. And they said, but you got the guy a bit wrong. Said, you know, we wouldn't work for the guy if he was totally as bad as you say. So you've got to realise that he was a man to be feared, yes. But, I mean, he had a lot of really talented people working for him, and that doesn't happen accidentally. And they really were. Then I'll tell you two Rickover stories, and then I'll let you read one.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of my favourites is of one of Harry Mandel's successors in the job of, of foreign relationships. One day, early on, when he was part of Rickover's team, this was not a naval officer, he was a civilian, engineer. He went into Rick Irving's, stop me if you've heard this one, into Rick Irving's office, and Rick Irving said, I like your tie. You know? Thank you, Admiral. No, I like your tie. Oh, thank you very much, Admiral. No, I would like your tie. Oh, well, I tell you what, Admiral, I bought it just down in the shop, you know, and there's lots like, no, I would like your tie. Well, I'm sorry, Admiral, but I'm telling you what, it's really, they're just down the road. Get out of the office. And he was called back later that day. Ricky said, open the cupboard. He said, those are the ties of the guys that gave it to me, and I sacked him.
He could have only given him one of my ties.
Isn't that amazing?
Good test, I suppose.
Of what? Test
character. If you'll stand up to your superior.
So, this is one by Ted Rockwell. Early one day in the programme, when everyone was working flat out, Panoff rushed into Rick Irving's office. Panoff was the third guy who lobbied for his promotion. To ask why he had just fired a man they had recently put in charge of an important part of the technical work, a man they had worked long and hard to recruit and train, who by all reports had been doing well. Rick Irving looked genuinely surprised. What the hell are you talking about? Panoff looked quite surprised. He's cleaning out his desk. He told me you fired him. Where'd he get that idea? My God, I didn't fire him. We need him around here. He's just beginning to get that shop in shape. What's gotten into him? He said you called him in here a while ago and told him he had screwed everything up and you'd be better off without him. In fact, you said the world would be better off if he'd never been born. Oh, he shouldn't take it personally, for God's sake. Why would he take it personally?
Would you read it now?
Yeah. Just the bottom.
This one here?
Yeah. Well, no, I think you've got to start there.
Get in the
book. Yeah. Can't have dinner. Is that amazing?
No.
And,
what about?
I give this lecture every year down at Salton to the Nuclear Submariners joining the program during their course. And Peter Kim comes to tell this story. He's magnificent. Magnificent.
Grief. Certainly a larger than life personality is all Rick over. I've got to say that.
Now, there's one aspect we haven't covered, and that is. Why the Atomic Energy Authority was cut out of the deal.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's pretty important.
Yeah.
Because right at the outset, when Rick Irving visited, one of his early visits, he gave a lecture in the Admiralty Cinema, something like that, at Mark Batten's request. Mark Batten chaired the session, which was for top civil servants, brass, Atomic Energy Authority, and so on. Well, the first thing I should say is that right at the beginning of the program, the Admiralty wrote to the Atomic Energy Authority this amazing letter asking for the Atomic, saying we're about to develop a nuclear submarine and asking for the Atomic Energy Authority to give all the facilities and help and everything else, because obviously the Atomic Energy Authority was seen as the natural people.
The handwriting was...
Lang?
Yeah. J.B. Lang. Yeah.
Okay. And this is a letter which is a bit hard to read because I photoed it. Unfortunately, I failed to photo the reference, so I can't find it again. Just mind that. But this is Atomic Energy Authority person reporting back to... about this presentation by Rick Irving in the cinema. There were three significant points concerning organisation. Rick Irving went out of his way to compliment the Risley organisation, which he described as being the best engineering organisation which he had encountered in the UK. He urged the First Sea Lord to ensure that Risley played a large part in nuclear submarine design. He emphasised, blah, 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 blah. worth reading. He emphasized that the change to a nuclear source of power affected the design of all the mechanical electrical parts of the submarine so fundamentally as to necessitate the appointment of one man empowered to take decision on all aspects of design. In other words, in his opinion, there should be a Rickover in every nuclear submarine program. But the real important thing was that he rated Risley very high. But within a year, he'd done a total about-turn and absolutely wouldn't allow the Atomic Energy Authority any part of the program at all. And I think that's one of the most interesting bits about that year, 57 to 58.
Based on Rickover's personal dislike of a man.
So I conclude that Rickover came to believe that firm-to-firm exchange would distance the government, as we've discussed, and that as a government agency, having authority involvement will undermine this separation. But there's a more significant one. From his earliest visits to the UK and before, Rickover was keen to learn all about Britain's first nuclear power plant called Hall. He argued that his generosity in letting the UK have his submarine propulsion plant should be matched by the UK generosity with the Calderhall design information. But the authority absolutely refused, and Rickover was deeply offended. He claimed that the Atomic Energy Authority was being more secretive over development in the nuclear power field than he was contemplating the Americans should be in the nuclear propulsion field. And that quote is from the meeting on the 24th of January. It's in the second page, that quote. So he was really upset towards the end.
So the AEA is saying they're unwilling to give advanced information about nuclear power.
So, but according to Harry Mandel in that email from Ted Rockwell, there was a further reason. He said, the people at Risley, prior to the exchange program talks, have been quite uncooperative, nasty in his words. They would not release any technical information on their program, but kept asking for information on shipping port. So that's one reason Rickover wanted to keep them out. He was concerned they would slow things up. Probably realistic. So that's Harry Mandel's comment on that. But the Atomic Energy Authority didn't have much time for Rickover either. There's this lovely quote. His status, this is in a letter to the Prime Minister, his status in the US Atomic Energy Commission is that he is a member of staff. Because of his subordinate position, he has no part in the wider policy making of the Commission, either in the weapons field, apart from naval matters, or in the civil field. That's the Atomic Energy Authority writing to the Prime Minister about Rickover before Rickover's call at number 10, which is a crazy thing to say. How could they claim that when his team had designed 5 nuclear submarine plants and shipping port?
I don't think they're too well briefed, that's all I can say.
Well, they were just so hacked off.
Yeah.
But when Rickover got back home, and was still muttering about Atomic Energy Authority and not letting him have called whole information, he was put in his place by the chairman of the Congressional Subcommittee, Senator Pastor, who was clear that called whole should not be brought into the equation. And he told Rickover, bilaterals do contemplate reciprocity, but it does not include called whole, which has to do with another thing. We ought not to confuse the two, i.e. Calderhall and submarine, because if we do, we may be in trouble. Well, of course, that's a reference to Calderhall being there to actually generate plutonium and not in a civil power reactor. So, you know, he didn't get his way. But I mean, genuinely, Rickover had this voracious appetite for technical or knowledge and information, and it was entirely in character that any nuclear reactor anywhere in the world, he wanted to know all about and the details. He was tremendously, you know, self-questioning, and he just soaked up information and knowledge, and what required his team to do the same. So it was a very natural thing for him to want, in his eyes, but equally, people in the weapons field, you know, obviously, did not want any of that to spread across and contaminate anything. So, that's why he cut the Atomic Energy Authority out. He didn't like it. The chances are they were behaving in a very arrogant way.
Well,
that's my speculation.
Yeah. We're all free to speculate, I suppose.